Francisco and Renee, like some of the other people in the video, are in sanctuary in St. Leo's Church in Tacoma. And it's that church community that was an inspiration for me in my beginning to work with refugees. And St. Leo's is really an example of a community of faith. If you ever have a chance to go to Tacoma, they're really an inspiring and a wonderful bunch of people. Churches that are sanctuaries are really public sanctuaries in certain instances, like St. Leo's and Southside Presbyterian Church in Tucson. Their church community as a whole has taken on the risk of helping refugees in order to protect them from possible arrest and the eventual deportation that could occur if they were arrested. The church usually goes through a process of discernment before they become a sanctuary, and they talk about the pros and cons of doing it, and they take the risks on knowingly that things could conceivably come up, like is happening right now with the people on trial in Tucson. Francisco and Renee offered to give their testimony and to share their experiences and thoughts with other people in order to help them to understand what is really happening in El Salvador and in Guatemala, so that we all might act in some way to improve the situation, to be actors of hope, actresses of hope, agents of hope. I work for the Salvadoran Guatemalan Refugee Program, which in a different way is providing sanctuary, but it is sanctuary nonetheless. We assist refugees who have been arrested by the Immigration and Naturalization Service and are facing deportation proceedings. Usually our first contact with the refugee is when they call us up from jail, whether from Chelan County Jail or another jail in the state of Washington, saying, my bail is $3,000. I need help so I can get out of jail. And that's where our program, which is a program of the Washington Association of Churches, comes into action, by first seeing how many resources the family has and then appealing to churches and individuals throughout the state to see if we can raise that money so that person can get out of jail. It happens that the hearings that the refugees have to go through before deportation occur a lot faster if they're in jail. In addition, the refugee can easily become discouraged in the midst of sitting in that jail. And not only are they in jail in Washington State, although they may be arrested in Washington State, they get sent sometimes to El Centro, California, which is a refugee camp of about 500 people with a number of nationalities represented, but mostly Salvadorans. And it gets to about 120 degrees during the summertime. And last summer, the refugees had to stand out in the sun for 14 hours a day. Conditions were really difficult for them. And it's to places like these that refugees are sent. So our program seeks to raise the bail that's needed to help get them out of jail. And there are two ways that this happens, one through cash and another is through collateral. Churches sometimes volunteer to put up property to use as collateral for the amount of the bail to help them get out of jail. St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church in Seattle went through about a four-month discernment, and they just decided last week to provide bail for refugees for our program. And that was a really wonderful thing for us. And it was especially good because it brought people into the discussion who had not been concerned about things in Central America before, who may have disagreed about helping refugees or had different viewpoints. But St. Joseph's was working toward consensus and everyone's viewpoints were shared, and then they still came to this decision. So that makes it a really good sign for the refugees. Our program works in other areas, and I'll briefly mention those. We help provide housing for refugees when they first come to the Seattle area in particular, either in home settings or in inexpensive hotels or low-cost apartments where they can get on their feet and they're able to survive if they're able to get work. And we provide some assistance for them to get jobs. We also make referrals for health care, ID cards, driver's licenses, and other services. We've had a number of different experiences as a staff of four in our office. And I'll just share briefly two of them, just two minor things. There's one refugee who is of Guatemalan descent, and we were fortunate enough to find him a job in a suburb of Seattle. But he was unable to live in that town, so he had to live in Seattle because he could find a place to stay there. So there was a group of three women that got up at 4:30 every morning on a rotating basis and drove him to work, the half-hour drive. And that was really inspiring for me, people to take that sacrifice on. Another experience which made me really feel good about the program is this one Salvadoran man who had come to Seattle and whose case was under appeal for asylum. And he went for a job interview with one of our staff people, and the potential employer asked him, "Well, have you ever worked as a dishwasher before?" And he said, "No, but I would love the opportunity to say yes. No one has ever asked me if I could work." And he ended up getting that job and continued to hold it for a while. So it's in those little ways that our program, through the refugees, are a sign of hope. Our program works with refugees throughout the state of Washington. There are a number of refugees in the Tri-Cities area, and there are also a number of refugees in the greater Wenatchee area. It's interesting that there are not so many Salvadorans and Guatemalans in the Yakima area. And the reason for that is, what happened was a few years ago, a Salvadoran family moved to Wenatchee. And what happened was eventually some relatives of theirs came, and then some more relatives, and then a few friends of theirs. And suddenly we have a Salvadoran community in the Wenatchee area, extending, you know, outward toward Quincy and the other direction to Leavenworth and going south. These refugees have the same needs as the refugees in the Seattle area. But one thing that there is a difference in is that there are many families in the Wenatchee area compared with in the Seattle area. There are a lot of single men in the Seattle area, which makes it doubly difficult if the family is unable to get work or if they get arrested. Because if they get arrested, it means they have to raise bail and then they'll have to pay someone back for that. And then they may lose their job if they're in jail. And then they have to come to Seattle for every interview that they're going to have and every hearing. And there are a number of those hearings. Plus they have the fear that they might be deported at some point down the road. It's hopeful and it's good that the whole process is lengthened out. And it's partly lengthened out by the fact that there's legal representation for all the refugees who need it through an organization called the Joint Legal Task Force that works closely with our program. And they have 150 volunteer attorneys who assist the refugees. But at the same time, we come back to a basic situation where the refugees need our support because they could be deported at a later point. And so I'm just going to suggest real briefly a couple of areas where people up here might keep the refugees in mind, and people going back to Wenatchee and other areas. One area, of course, is bail. And the bail very concretely helps the refugees to get out of jail. And it allows them to stay in the country. And that bail is returned to the people who give the bail at the end of the hearings and interview process. And our program keeps contact with the refugees so that they are able to attend their hearings and interviews and do make it back. A second area is in the area of the human need and human services. In Seattle recently, we had two refugees, two young men who were 17 years old who came to Seattle, and neither of them had an overcoat. And knowing that they lived in Quincy, it made me think, well, it's a lot colder in Quincy than it is in Seattle. And I asked them if they were working. They said, no, I can't find work. And I know that there are other people and other families in this area that are really struggling, and struggle particularly in the winter months. In the summer months, they're able to get work in the fields. But the winter months in this area, it's very difficult for them. So there might be a possibility of helping them in that area. An area that I will not underemphasize is prayer. Your prayers are needed, and prayers mean a lot. Another area is in terms of writing letters. It is a concrete way of helping. There is a bill called the Deconcini-Moakley Bill, which would allow Salvadorans to temporarily stay in the country while a study is done by the General Accounting Office about the situation for refugees in El Salvador and also conditions for people who are deported from the United States, which we know to be very difficult, but our government is not convinced of that, hence the need for that type of legislation. There is a similar bill that is going through Congress for Guatemalans. The Salvadoran bill has a lot more strength at this moment, but we need your support in both those areas. I'm not sure where Congressman Morrison stands on the Deconcini-Moakley bill, but it'd be good to write to him about that. I'll say one more thing. For people who are particularly, who are not necessarily up here, but maybe in Wenatchee area, if you're interested in keeping a regular contact with our program and to keep contact with some of the refugees in your area, that would be a particular help to us. Refugees often go where the work is, and sometimes it's possible to lose track of them. And we We've had the assistance of Reverend Marvin Thill from Sunny Slope Church of the Brethren in Wenatchee. And unfortunately, he's leaving the area really soon. So it places more of an urgency for us in that area for continued contact with the church community in this area. And to that in that way, Francisco, Renee, and I are going to speak at Sunny Slope Church of the Brethren tomorrow night. And we'll continue to try to keep contact with Reverend Thill and with the group that's called Apoyo, or Help, that's working in that area. It's an ecumenical group. I'll just point out, before I take some questions, that there are a number of books here on Archbishop Romero, whose death we remember on the 24th of March, which is coming up. And the books are here and they're available for sale, and they go to support the refugee program. And also we have some brochures here that describe our program in a little detail. And if at any point you would like to make a donation to our program, you can make a check out to the Washington Association of Churches and mark it for the Salvador and Guatemalan Refugee Program. I'd also like to thank the community here for offering your financial help to our program, and also for inviting me here and for inviting Francisco and Renee also. It's been a real pleasure and a privilege. And so I thank you. The driver's license department and the identification card department they operate independently in our area, and there's no problem doing it. I don't know how to explain it. They're able to do it, and it's important for them because in a way it legitimizes their presence and helps them to get around. And it's real important. I didn't mention before that, you know, the language barrier is an extremely difficult thing, and you know, Francisco and Renee could probably talk about it more, but
in Spanish.
But the language barrier is really important, and most of the refugees are taking English classes, but it's a really difficult thing to overcome. It's hard to find work. It's hard just culturally to survive. You know, I had an interesting discussion with Francisco and Renee last night about food and what they're used to eating. And they told me that they brought a bunch of little soups for breakfast because they're not used to the standard American cereal and that kind of food. And it's just little things like that I, you know, just didn't see before, which are big things when you're trying to adjust to a culture that doesn't speak your language, that you're unfamiliar with, and that there are forces working that are trying to get you in some way. So it's really a double burden that they're trying to overcome.
Is there a concern on the part of employees if they hire refugees? In other words, is there some legal aspect to that makes them hesitate, or are they not put in any kind of illegal position by doing so?
There's a bill in Congress called the Simpson Bill. It was formerly the Simpson-Mazzoli Bill, which would penalize employers of refugees if they hired four or more. But that bill has not passed, and many people, including myself, feel that bill is discriminatory because It would make employers discriminate against anyone who looks Hispanic because they'd be afraid of the penalties they'd suffer if they hired someone. But that bill has not gone through Congress. It has never had the strength to go through. Right now, an employer or a refugee suffers no legal consequences and has no legal risk by hiring a refugee.
Can they get Social Security numbers?
Refugees can get Social Security numbers after they are arrested and after they file an application for asylum with the immigration office.
They have to be arrested first to get a Social Security number?
Well, a refugee can turn himself or herself in to the immigration service, but no one does that because it's just beginning the process of leading toward deportation. It's like signing, you know, your return ticket to El Salvador or Guatemala to do that. So no one does that. Of course, the immigration officers say, well, of course you can come in any time and fill out these forms and begin the process. But no, people don't do that, although they know that it's difficult for them.
So they can't get a Social Security number unless they go to immigration, you're saying?
Unless they turn themselves in or get arrested. However, it's kind of a complicated question. The refugees are in a very difficult position. They are here, and they don't want to be arrested. But they have to survive. They have to eat, and they have to live somewhere, so they have to work. And they do work. Of course, then the Immigration Service can say, well, you're here just to work. And so it's used against them later on. And so it's really a difficult
Mike,
thing.
Mike?
Yeah?
Creo que entiendo lo que están diciendo. También hay una cosa que tal vez en 100 salvadoreños que solicitan asilo político, 99 son deportados, y es por eso que tenemos miedo. Yo tengo miedo de acercarme a las oficinas a solicitar asilo. ¿Podrías decirles eso?
Ellos lo solicitan en sí mismo.
Casi nadie lo hace, casi nadie tiene miedo de ser deportados. Pues.
There were 100 Salvadorans who
eran arrestados.
Es un porcentaje.
Son deportados.
The situation for Salvadorans is that 100% of the refugees, or almost 100%, end up being deported if they're arrested or if they turn themselves in. So that's the situation that they face. So they're not going to turn themselves in, and that's why it makes it real difficult in terms of assisting the refugees too, in the overall situation. Because what's needed is really a change in the laws and to an extent the system that allows the attitude to be one of hostility rather than of compassion. I was in Canada for a conference last year, and the Minister of Immigration of Canada, of the whole country, came to the conference, a refugee conference, and spoke and said, we must have compassion for the refugees. And then she took questions from a panel of people, said, how can we improve our immigration policies? Now, only would it be that we could get our immigration officials and our Secretary of State and our Attorney General to come to Holden Village or to come to our churches and to listen in the Congress to suggestions about immigration policy. But it just means that we have to act to try to do what we can to help and to try to change things. Go ahead.
Do local employers discriminate against them in payment of their wages because they realize that they have no social security card, that they are refugees. Therefore, they can get by paying them less money. Does that happen?
Well, they basically don't get paid very much. I mean, but there have been some cases of that. I haven't really heard a lot about that, so I can't answer your question very well. Go ahead.
To follow that up in Gloria's question, if a refugee does not have a social security number, what are they faced with when they try to get a job? Can an employer hire somebody who doesn't have a social security number?
Well, an employer cannot hire someone who does not have a social security number. So what I haven't said it directly, but the refugees find a way to get a social security number so that they can work. And they do it so that they can live. That's their situation and that's their bind they're in.
También otra forma es como nosotros hemos sobrevivido y es diferente.
Another way that we have survived is a different way.
Afortunadamente en nuestra comunidad hemos caído bien y nos quieren.
Fortunately, things in our community have fallen in a good way.
Y entre ellos nos invitan a arreglarles el jardín o arreglar golpes en sus carros.
And people in our community have offered for us to tend their gardens and to fix their cars.
O algunas veces ayudar a pintar sus casas. Y de esa forma, sin necesidad de número de seguro social, hemos podido trabajar.
And sometimes to paint houses, and in this way, we've been able to work without a social security number.
Pero realmente tenemos el apoyo de la comunidad de Tacoma.
But really, we have the help of the community of Tacoma.
Y nunca nos hemos considerado que no queremos ser una carga para la comunidad que nos apoya.
And we've never considered that we were a burden for the community that assists us.
Queremos ganar nuestro propio dinero para nuestra comida, para nuestros gastos pues más importantes.
We're trying to earn so that we can get the basic necessities of food and shelter.
Y así pues sin necesidad de número social, ¿verdad? De número de seguro. Hemos podido sobrevivir gracias a la comunidad que nos ha entendido.
And thus, without a social security number, we've been able to survive. They are until they can prove that they have, according to the Refugee Act of 1980, a well-founded fear of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, membership in a social group, or political opinion. Now, as we can see, the difference between Canada and the United States, they really interpret differently what that means. To the judges of immigration in the United States and to the State Department, it means that your name practically has to have appeared on a death squad list, but that you survived with the list in hand so that you can prove that you were persecuted. It means that the judge in Seattle can say, well, yeah, you may have a well-founded fear in your hometown that you might be killed, but you can go live somewhere else in El Salvador. Or it means that you were on the side of either the guerrillas or the army and you saw a massacre happen and you said, no, this is wrong, and you left from that, and you're still denied asylum, even though you could be persecuted if you go back because they knew you were on one side in the conflict. So it's a really, it's a difficult thing to get asylum, and the situation is a little bit better in Canada, but the solution has to really come out of ourselves, in our own country, in our own churches, in our own communities.
Do some end up going to Canada?
Some refugees do end up going to Canada. They've been getting more and more people, and so I think they're starting to tighten up their situation a little bit. It's still very difficult. Unemployment is higher in some parts of Canada, and again, the way of life is different. But we still have, you know, 500,000 Salvadoran refugees in the United States and 100,000 Guatemalans, and we need to discover ways amongst ourselves to continue to help them. I just want to make sure, did I answer your question okay?
Yeah, you did.
Okay.
Another question along the lines, how many of those 600,000 you just mentioned have received the condition of asylum?
For fiscal year 1984, about 328 Salvadoran applications for asylum were granted and 13,000 were denied. So it's 2.5%. For Guatemalans, the figure was 0.4%. So it's nearly impossible to get asylum. And the numbers for fiscal year 1985 so far that have come out, I've heard, are even lower percentages. The situation is one where the refugees are forced into applying for asylum when asylum is not the answer to their situation, even though that would be a step given what the possibilities are of deportation. These people have fled a situation of civil war in their own countries, and they need to be recognized as war refugees, and they're not being recognized as such, and they need extended voluntary departure, which would allow them all to stay. And so it's a question, it then by necessity becomes linked up with our foreign policy, which dictates what the State Department says about the refugees who are among us. So it becomes a big question. Go ahead.
Well, kind of two questions. Are there persons fleeing from the Nicaraguan government, and there are, what are the percentages of acceptance of people fleeing from Nicaragua to the United States? Mm-hmm. Does it differ? Is the United States, say, like if a Soviet person was to flee from the Soviet Union,
right,
the United States would welcome mm-hmm. them without any
right.
question?
Right. For Nicaraguans, the percentages are slightly higher for acceptance than Salvadorans and Guatemalans. Very, not just slightly higher, not a whole lot. It was something like 6 or 8%, I think. 1984. At the same time, there are less Nicaraguans who have come to the country than Guatemalans or Salvadorans. You made me think of an interesting point in terms of the figures for Poles, Afghanis, and Ugandans ranges from 20 to 40% of people accepted. So there's a difference there. And you know, it's linked with the foreign policy, the attitudes. People are fleeing from a communist country. It's a little bit easier than if to get asylum than if you're fleeing from El Salvador and Guatemala, as seeing the film this afternoon and knowing a little bit about the situation, you know, our government has a lot invested militarily in these countries. Your second question?
That was both questions.
Okay.
Once they are denied asylum, does that mean they are then automatically deported?
No, not right away, which is fortunate. I mean, it's a real good thing that the refugees are not deported right away. And one of the things that our program hopes to do is to give them a time to stay in the country while their hearings are going through. We're trying to help them along the way, and eventually they may have to go to Canada to avoid being deported. But after the hearing comes up, which may happen in 6 months or a year, it depends. There are two levels of appeal: to the Board of Immigration Appeals in Washington, D.C., and to the Ninth Circuit Court in San Francisco. And after you're denied on those levels, then you run to other options. You have possibility of going to Canada.
Question along that line: who gets arrested? In other words, is there anything that a refugee can do to sort of put off getting arrested? Or is that just done sort of happenstance? Who happens to be arrested and who isn't?
Well, I think the Immigration Service arrests thousands of people at the border and deports hundreds and eventually thousands of people. So, you know, hundreds of people from El Salvador and Guatemala have been deported just coming into the country.
At the border.
Yeah. Well, in this state, they're arrested often in the workplace. They raid the fields and arrest everyone who's there, and they might find some Mexican people, and they'll find a few Salvadorans there too, possibly, or Guatemalans, and they'll arrest them. But they're also, with this, the sanctuary situation, they arrested 60 refugees throughout the country who were in sanctuary too. None of those refugees were residing in the church at that particular time. The government's reluctant to go into churches to actually arrest people, although they feel comfortable going into churches to tape Bible study meetings. But, question?
Do you know of any illegal activities by our Immigration Service in finding out who these people are? Do they tap your phone, do you think, to find out names, or do they open people's mail? Those kind of things happen?
Sure they have. Yeah, University Baptist Church in Seattle's been broken into, and they've had two people who've infiltrated their church for 8 months. Sure, and there's a concern in Seattle that there's a feeling, at least that I've heard, that they think Seattle may be the next place that immigration cracks down on. It's hard to say what Immigration Service, and also we're not only talking about Immigration Service, we're talking about FBI and National Security Agency. I don't know exactly what's happening, but at the same time, the more I read about it, the more conscious I am that the technology is incredibly sophisticated at this point for phone tapping and surveillance, and it's really scary. It's scary on that level. I think they're more concerned with the Immigration Service overall is more concerned with public sanctuaries than it is with our refugee program per se, but we still have to be careful. In any case, what we do you know, for the refugees, our interaction with them is basically confidential. So we work on that trust anyway. You know, and we, you know, and ultimately we trust that what we're doing is right. It was, you said something at the beginning, is anything that the Immigration Service doing illegal? You know, by the letter of the law, yes, in some ways, but beyond that, they're doing a lot. I think what they're doing to the refugees is illegal by deporting back to El Salvador and Guatemala, and you know what can happen to them there. So on another level, that's illegal too.
The reason I ask that is, I have a friend who lives in Kashmir, and he has a post office box, and refugees receive their mail in his post office box. And I'm wondering if he's doing that as a protection to them, letting them use his box so that their mail is not opened or something, for some reason.
Probably not. I wouldn't think so necessarily, but it's possible. You know, I think, you know, any of the refugees around can be subject to arrest, but I think the more visible you are, the more risk you run. I think Francisco and Renee run more of a risk than some of the others.
St. Anne's in Spokane was broken into. The sanctuary church.
Why don't we take one more question or comment?
How does deportation work? Once all the hearings and things are finished and they've been denied asylum, do they just hand a refugee a bus ticket and expect them to make their way back down the border, or
do you think that they're going to trust a refugee, give them a bus ticket, and think they're going to go back to El Salvador?
How does it work? Because they can't accompany every refugee back to.
Well, they give them what's called a, you know, you demonstrate. They give them what's called a bag and baggage letter, which means you get your bags and baggage, and you're supposed to appear at the immigration office on X, Y, or Z date. But I'll tell you what really happens is we get a call from Arizona saying this refugee is supposed to be deported on such and such a date, and can you help him go to Canada? And that's, I've had experiences doing that, and I, you know, do it, and it, you know, it works fairly well.